from the Sky News Centre at 5. A £60 million government probe into allegations of abuse involving British soldiers will be shut down by the summer. It follows pressure from MPs who say the Iraq Historic Allegations team has been an unmitigated failure. Defence Secretary Sir Michael Fallon says the way soldiers have been treated is terrible.
This will be a huge relief to hundreds of British troops who've had these quite unfair allegations hanging over them, and we will put in place new measures now to prevent completely malicious and unfounded allegations being made against our brave servicemen and women.
A 27-year-old from Blackburn has become the first British woman to join the fight against so-called Islamic State in Syria. Maths graduate Kimberly Taylor joined the YPJ, a female unit within the Kurdish forces, last year. She says she felt compelled to sign up because of the influence the unit has on young women in the country.
It's not just about joining to go to war. They join and they get education in politics, on the situation of the world, on poverty, on war, on patriarchy, on history, on all of these subjects.
A man and woman have died after a fire at a house in Manchester. Four children have been taken to hospital. Another man is said to be in a serious condition following the blaze early this morning. President Trump says he'll fight a court ruling against reinstating his travel ban on seven mainly Muslim countries. In the last few hours, he's called the ruling disgraceful and tweeted to the judges who overturned his ruling, "See you in court." It's claimed one-fifth of commuters who use a machine to buy their train tickets end up with the wrong one. The rail regulators found 13% are choosing more expensive fares. And the energy regulator Ofgem's warned against rampant price increases after Scottish Power became the latest supplier to announce higher bills. Electricity will rise by an average of 10.8% and gas by 4.7% from the end of March. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Yes, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative candidate for Metro Mayor, Tim Bowles. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, 500,000 children are under threat of starvation in Yemen as we speak because the Royal Navy, US Navy and Saudi navies are blockading the country. Why? Well, British arms firms made £3.3 billion selling arms to Saudi Arabia last year. Perhaps that's got something to do with it. And our servicemen and women aren't in danger because they're mostly killing unarmed civilians. The majority of the 10,000 people the UN said last month have now been killed in the Middle East's most poor country and the cradle of Arab civilization. For President Trump, the village of Yakala in Yemen presented an opportunity for him on Sunday, the 29th of January, to sign off his first special operations raid. His Navy SEALs killed 23 civilians, including an 80-year-old man, as well as an 8-year-old girl and a newborn baby. The secret video they say they seized wasn't. It was available online all the time. And continuing on from last week, we look at my acronym for protecting yourself in a cyber war. And it's not as unlikely as it seems. Murmurings from the Bilderberg meetings, statements from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and our own secret services are telling us to prepare for a cyber attack from Russia. No doubt personally supervised by Vladimir Putin himself. Acronym is prefabs. We looked at passwords last week. We'll do our best to run through them all for you tonight. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of zero. Some light sleet or snow is possible, and possibly frosty too. This weekend, highs of 3 Celsius. Really cold, isn't it? Mainly cloudy weekend. Feeling cold, some possible sleet or snow. snow too across the weekend. Next week, highs up again to 11 Celsius, warming up as the week progresses with plenty of sunshine. Next weekend is the 18th and 19th of February, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Conservative candidate for Metro Mayor Tim Bowles. But before we hear from Tim, a note on our lack of MP guests over the last few months. I can promise you it's not for lack of trying. We only hear from them when they ask questions at Prime Minister's Questions these days, which is rare. In the immortal words of former Lib Dem cabinet member Simon Cook, we'll keep trying. I've written over the last 3 weeks or so to all the MPs. Apologies came back from Jack Napresti and Charlotte Leslie. Wrote me a nice letter saying that they're too busy at the moment and to try again in a few months' time. But no reply at all from Conservative for Kingswood Chris Skidmore and the three Bristol Labour MPs, Karen Smith, Kerry McCarthy and Thangam Devonair. Also been trying to get hold of Marvin Rees because, of course, he stood on a platform of transparency. Haven't managed to get him. I tried for the first time around about September, October time, and still over the last 2 weeks, several calls into the City Council, still no reply. And Marvin, of course, is a Yale World Fellow. That is a little bit similar to the sort of reverse of the Rhodes Scholarships, where US young people come over to study in Oxford. And I can't quite work. I really want to ask Marvin this, what degrees he's got, because there's so many different degrees he seems to have on the various biographies around the internet. Apparently he's got a master's degree on black American politics, which he got in 1995, a master's degree in political theory, and also a master's degree in global economic development. So anyway, hopefully Marvin will be on in the next few weeks, and I'll keep you updated as to how we're getting on, getting hold of the MPs and getting hold of the mayor. Anyway, after all that, hi Tim, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello Tony.
Tim Bowles, you're standing as a Metro Mayor. What is a Metro Mayor?
A Metro Mayor is going to be a new role for what is being referred to as the West of England region. That region will cover all of the area that's currently part of Bristol City Council, part of Bath and North East Somerset Council and South Gloucestershire Council. So it'll be covering all of those areas, and the responsibilities of the mayor will be primarily around ways of investing new money that will be coming from the government to address the shortages in infrastructure that we see in the area, to try to give a boost to the housing that we all need, to look at new ways of improving our transport challenges. But really underneath all of that, it's really to try and get our economy booming and keep it moving forward. We've got a really good story here in the region about the economy, and if we think about all of those areas that we've just discussed, they all feed into that, and that will then allow us to develop new jobs, new skills, to develop the region and keep it moving.
Now, this idea of new money, well, that surely is kind of gobbledygook, really, because we're having all these cuts, roughly £30 million of cuts, so this money isn't really new, it's just going to come through a different channel.
Well, this is new money that's coming down from the government. It's being specifically identified because of the needs that everybody in the region keeps identifying for investment in infrastructure.
But you see what I'm saying? It's £30 million less for the City Council, so this isn't really new. It's just being shifted over towards the Metro Mayor slowly.
Well, as I say, I see it as new money that's coming in for infrastructure investment across the region. So it's not specific to one particular council. It's to try and address the needs that we all have in joining up those challenges, because as we all know, infrastructure, transport, housing doesn't respect the red line of a boundary out there. So it's really about new investment for those areas.
OK, so where has it come from, this whole idea of a Metro Mayor? What's the point?
Okay. Going back one, if we like, to the identifying that there is a need regionally, at the moment the government's thinking here, and I think it's very sound, is to find a way of bringing those local authorities together, to start thinking together collectively to try and find solutions to, as we say, the need for new houses, the need for improved skills, the need for more jobs, to bring that together and drive it forward like that.
Now, we've already got these things called the Local Enterprise Partnership, West of England Partnership, these kinds of things. I mean, are these already doing things which the Metro Mayor will be involved in? I mean, are they any part of why we've got a Metro Mayor?
Okay. They are already in existence, you're right. They are groups that have been formed to develop various thinking in different areas like that. The reason the government is now looking at having a West of England mayor is to have somebody who stands aside from all of that to make some of those tough decisions and make sure that they're being made in the best interest of everybody in the region. So it will involve working with the local enterprise partnerships and the West of England groups as well, but also with the heads of the respective councils, our MPs, the business leaders, and trying to coordinate everything like that so we're getting long-term thinking, ambitious thinking in how we challenge these problems and address it on that basis, Tony.
Well, let's take a look at you. What's your background? Why are you coming to this role?
Okay. I've come to the role as somebody who's experienced both in work, worked all my life in the private sector, working in a number of different roles in management.
Well, just take us through some of those places where you've worked. Give us an idea, paint a picture of your history.
Okay. I have worked most of my life in sales and marketing, in various management roles with that, delivering to targets, making things happen from business perspectives. I've been very lucky to be working for quite a number of years now in a very exciting industry, in the exhibition and events industry, and in that I help a lot of companies to go and promote their business, take their products both around the UK and abroad, promote industry and try and help in that sense. So that's really part
of
my role.
Have you worked in any big companies around the southwest then?
Yes, I work for one of the industry's leading companies based in Yate at the moment, and I've worked for a number of other large companies, industry-leading companies in the southwest.
So who
as well.
Are you working for at the moment?
A very, very exciting company based in Yate. They specialise in exhibition and events work.
Who are they?
Say, a company called RTH.
Right.
I'm trying not to be promoting my business too much. My company owners will probably be very pleased at that, but I'm trying to be fair. Other exhibition companies do exist.
And why the Conservative Party? What's the interest of the Conservatives for you? Why would not say the Lib Dems or Labour or one of the other parties?
Okay. I grew up in a family that weren't very strongly political but had some very sound values. My father was a small businessman when I was growing up, and I can remember the challenges that he was facing then.
In what sort of business?
We came back from abroad, and my father eventually started running a village post office and shop. I've got other family in various other businesses of their own and working in lots of other areas. So I became a Conservative really when I started looking at how business works, how free trade works, things of that nature. So really when I started to become aware of how both the jobs market worked and everything else, that's where I really saw.
Was there anything over the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years or whatever that made you think, wow, that's why I'm a Conservative, of the political history of the country?
Political history of the company goes back a lot further than that.
Is there anything you can point to and say, wow, that's why I'm a Conservative?
There isn't one thing, no. There's a number of things. It is freedom of choice. It is trying to have fairness in terms of opportunities for people, and that's really where I got attracted.
How do you stand on privatisation? Because some of those haven't really worked very well. I mean, we've got all this hoo-ha today about the electricity industry, with some customers having to have massive, massive increases in their electricity bills, whereas others are getting none. And although there is some sort of competition, what quite often happens is companies will wait for a while for people to switch to them, and then they'll put their prices up. It's a bit of a game where the consumer is just befuddled, caught in the middle, and ripped off.
We see that in lots of areas, and I agree. I think if people are trying to fix markets, that's wrong, without a doubt, whether it's in the energy market or any of those others that we were discussing a little earlier. So, no, totally against that. Free markets should be looking to give the best opportunities and the best opportunities for all consumers.
Well, they should be, but they're not.
Well, as I say, I think that in a market like that, what will happen is you'll find that one of the suppliers will identify that opportunity, and then they'll start hopefully starting bringing better value to people.
What about what the Conservatives are doing with the National Health Service at the moment? Many people saying, actually it looks like they're trying to kill it off and sell it off to American healthcare firms.
Okay. I think what we need to look at there is the fact that there is a huge amount of money being invested in the health service by the government, and I think if that was the case, that certainly doesn't justify the suggestion of privatisation. So I really don't see that is the case. The country is changing in terms of its age profile, so on. There are a lot of different challenges facing the health service, and we do need to start looking at the way we can address those for the future.
Well, we're going to hear a bit more about the health service in a second, but good. I mean, if you had to say one pitch why people should vote for you as Metro Mayor, why should they?
I would like to think that I can bring the business experience into this very important role. Also, having been a councillor for many years, I think I've got the expertise at working with council levels, also working with business, MPs, pulling everybody together, working with the other parts of the community as well as I do on a daily basis to start making some real changes, not looking backwards at what's happened in the past, trying to look forward and have some ambition.
So whereabouts have you been a councillor before then?
I'm a councillor in South Gloucestershire.
Oh, you are now? Okay.
Yes.
Where in South Gloucestershire?
I live in Winterbourne, just north of Bristol.
And is there anything you'd like to tell us about the things that have been going on up there and things you've been involved in as a councillor up in South Gloucestershire?
Okay. I'm one of the leadership team on the South Gloucestershire Council. So I've been involved in quite a various things in terms of policy, in terms of all the budget aspects and really driving through some of the savings that we're all needing to make. So I've been involved in lots of various areas on that, Tony, whether it's been looking at budgets for New Year, which we'll be discussing on Wednesday, whether it's looking at how we're trying to implement some of the savings and efficiencies that are going on, whether it comes down to a very local level, as I've been involved in a number of different things, clearly involved in Winterbourne for many years.
One of the cases which has been chugging its way through the courts here in Bristol is of a Conservative councillor who was a rogue estate agent for a drugs gang growing cannabis in Bristol. Linda Churchill writing about this in the Bristol Post. A Tory councillor was a rogue estate agent for a sophisticated drugs gang which grew more than £1 million worth of cannabis, a court was told. Donald Hassett used false names, references and cover stories to rent Bristol houses which were turned into drug factories, the jury were told. Police found 1,285 plants with a street value of almost £1.1 million growing at 7 properties, 4 of which were linked to the politician. One of them apparently was also the home that belonged to a vicar. So this isn't a very good record, is it?
No, you're right. I wasn't aware of links of vicars. So I'm not sure whether we're referring to vicars or councillors.
Well, it was a vicar. Let's be very clear. It was a vicar whose home he let to this Tory councillor, and then it was used as a drug factory.
Thank you. Let's be very clear. Whoever is involved,
allegedly. I don't know.
Thank you.
Because the case is still going on.
Let's bring allegedly in. I completely condemn anything of that nature. The story you have just told me is really unacceptable. I wasn't aware the gentleman was a Bristol councillor. I think
he's a Bath councillor, actually.
I was going to say.
But the case is taking place in Bristol.
Thank you. I believe, like that, I thought he was a Bath and North East Somerset councillor. The Conservative Party immediately withdrew the whip. His seat, I believe, is up for re-election, so completely condemn any action of that nature.
Also, so we get back to the NHS, and we will, former Conservative government health advisor has now joined a US firm involved in NHS privatisation. This is Katie Forster. I'm not quite sure what paper this was in. Sorry, I usually write it down here, but it's Friday the 3rd of Feb anyway. Theresa May says the NHS is not for sale in response to concerns health service could be included in post-Brexit trade deal between the US and the UK. A former government health advisor, though, has joined a US firm involved in NHS privatisation. A move, campaigners say, demonstrates the wafer-thin partition between Tory policymakers and the private health industry. Executive Vice President, Nick Seddon, who was David Cameron's special advisor for health, became Executive Vice President of Optum just 4 months after he's left his political role in July last year. Now, this does sound like the old rotating doors, revolving doors syndrome, doesn't it? Where someone is in government working for the Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister, and all of a sudden they're there in industry.
Let's go back, if we may, to the suggestion about privatisation of the health service. I can assure you I have seen nothing that I believe supports that. Talking about people who have been politicians who no longer are, an awful lot of them from various parties do then start new careers. If anybody is trying to exploit their situation when they are a politician, I think that is completely wrong. But a lot of people do move on to new careers after they've finished their political career.
Anyway, the National Health Service came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, and here is Jeremy Corbyn.
Mr. Speaker, 9 out of 10 NHS trusts say their hospitals have been at unsafe levels of overcrowding. 1 in 6 accident and emergency units in England are set to be closed or downgraded. Could the Prime Minister please explain how closing A&E departments will tackle overcrowding and ever-growing waiting lists? Yeah.
First of all, can I extend my thanks, and I'm sure that of the whole House, to the hard-working staff in the NHS, who do a great job day in and day out treating patients. Yes, we recognise there are heavy pressures on the NHS. That's why this year we're funding the NHS at £1.3 billion more than the Labour Party promised at the last election. He refers specifically to accident and emergency. What is our response in accident and emergency? We see 600 more A&E consultants, 1,500 more A&E doctors and 2,000 more paramedics. It's not about standing up and making a soundbite and asking a question. It's about delivering results, and that's what this Conservative government is doing.
Now, Tim, there's some pretty damning allegations there. I mean, actually, there are facts behind them too, of course, which is the waiting times at accident and emergency hospitals are, it's apparently now 9 out of 10 are considered unsafe. And also there's the threatened closures and downgrading of accident and emergencies. 1 in 6 of those accident emergencies could be going. I mean, people are looking at their National Health Service and wondering if it's still going to be here by 2020, the probable time of the next general election.
Well, you've mentioned 2020, so I think it's important, as you've prompted that date, that we recognise the additional investment that the government's putting in up to 2020, which I think, as we just heard, will amount to an extra £10 billion. So I think there's a very, very clear commitment there from the Conservative government to the NHS. I think we touched earlier on the fact that things do change in terms of demographics and the way people are using the NHS. And I've got friends who are involved in the NHS who tell me stories, frankly worrying stories, about people who are using A&E for things that really are not accidents and emergencies.
Well, that's usually because they can't get a GP appointment.
I would suggest to you some of the stories I've heard aren't about GP stories. They are but very different to that, Tony. But if we go on from there, I mean, as we heard the Prime Minister talk a little earlier in the answer, if we look at what is actually happening in A&E in terms of the additional consultants, doctors, paramedics, so I think there's real evidence there that there are huge investments being made in A&E and in the NHS, and I think those are the important things we've got to bear in mind with all of this.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we have a problem with the National Health Service, also regionally, locally here. It looks as if Western Hospital may go over to only accepting accident and emergency patients between 8 a.m. and 9 or 10 p.m.
Well, I mean, obviously the National Health Service, I'm glad to hear that Tim supports the National Health Service, because if we can actually get consensus around that, that will be useful. But of course I am worried about the trade deal that is proposed with Donald Trump, because his demands will be clear, and we know from looking at the minutes of Margaret Thatcher's first cabinet that it was definitely discussed by the Tory government at the time that they wanted to get rid of the National Health Service. Now, I accept that Tim doesn't believe that, but you'll understand that there is still a fear that there is an ideological element within the government that isn't really committed to the National Health Service as a national
health
service.
Well, hang on a minute, because Douglas Carswell, who's the only UKIP MP, and Jeremy Hunt both penned a leaflet about how to privatise the National Health
Service? Well, indeed. So it's very difficult for those people to claim that they are in favour of the National Health Service if they've both penned publicly on the record as saying that they don't believe in it.
I think people care so much about this. Number one, because it was something that came out of the smoke, if you want, of the Second World War, where people were pulling people out of burning buildings and thinking, well, actually everybody deserves a decent service in these circumstances. And also because the we all rely on it, particularly we want a hand on something which is working to the young people and obviously for us as we get older.
Yes, and if I can just go back to Martin's point, yes, Margaret Thatcher's first cabinet minutes will have been a long time ago. I think a lot of things have moved forward from there. Yes, I can assure you that everybody I know from all parties are completely behind the NHS. I am passionately. I do realise what a brilliant job they do in so many different areas. So, yes, I'm very much about today and the future. Not looking back on that one, Martin, but it is important that we recognise that everybody I know is completely behind the NHS and we're all looking to make sure that we are delivering the very, very best service we can for people.
Well, also, there was a bit of a surprise at Prime Minister's Questions this week because we had Jeremy Corbyn having a text from someone from Surrey County Council, which was in danger of having a referendum because they were going to have to put up their council tax by quite a large amount. So anyway, let's have a listen to that now.
Mr. Speaker, I wonder if it's anything to do with the fact that the Chancellor and Health Secretary both represent Surrey constituencies. But, Mr. Speaker, there was a second text from Surrey County Council leader to Nick. And in the second text, it says the numbers you indicated are the numbers that I understand are acceptable for me to accept and call off the R. Now, I've been reading a bit of John le Carré, and apparently R means referendum. It's very subtle, all this. And he goes on to say in his text to Nick, if it is possible for that info to be sent to myself, I can then revert back soonest, really want to kill this off. So how much did the government offer Surrey to kill this off? And is the same sweetheart deal on offer to every council facing the social care crisis created by her government?
I've made clear to the Right Honourable Gentleman what has been made available to every council, which is the ability to raise the precept. And I have to say to him, he comes to the dispatch box making all sorts of claims. Yet again, what we get from Labour are alternative facts. What they really need is an alternative leader.
Tim Bowles, you're standing for Metro Mayor for the Conservatives. This is a little, I mean, certainly looks like damning evidence that there is a special deals being done from central government with local authorities that are Conservative local authorities, so they don't have to have these referendums, so they don't have to put up council tax. Now, that isn't fair, is it?
Well, I was, if I may, and I was going through my little address book a little earlier to see if I could find any Nicks in there that I know in government, and I can't find any who would actually admit to this. So moving on from that, I think the important thing here is what we heard at the end of that is, A, it's down to the individual councils to be speaking with government. I can speak from my experience here in South Gloucestershire that we haven't had any situations like that in terms of suggestions that are implied, and I can base that on my personal experience.
Special deals? Would you expect a special deal if you did have to put up the council tax?
No.
Martin?
Well, I think the problem with the funding for local government over many years is that the standard spending assessments have been skewed. So I don't think it's really disputable that prosperous areas like East Dorset have actually suffered less from the cuts than inner city Liverpool. And that's because of, you know, the sort of shenanigans that go on when the spending assessment is assessed. I think the problem with social care and funding of that by local authorities is problematic because we're getting into a postcode lottery. Some local authorities are relatively flush with cash, relatively speaking, and some are not. And that means that, and of course, some local authorities are able to put up council tax without causing major problems and others aren't. I would argue that social care should actually be an NHS responsibility, organised at national level, and that should be properly funded so that you can get the bed blocking, which is causing the problems in the NHS, resolved. And I think the idea that local councils, you know, fiddling around trying to raise council tax is a very regressive tax. The rates, which are still used in Northern Ireland, are a much more efficient system of local government taxation, but they were abolished, and we've still, like a lot of things in that era, we did silly things, and we've carried on doing them.
Okay, let's move on to another story now. It's not often we have international stories in the first hour, but an explosion has rocked the French nuclear power plant close to the English Channel after a fire broke out in the machine room. That's what they say anyway. This is at Flamanville. In fact, it's amazing. If you look at Flamanville, it's very similar to Hinkley because you've got two existing nuclear power stations plus this brand new one, which is apparently the same design as Hinkley, being built right next to it. But EDF, whose controversial Hinkley Point plant in Somerset will be built with Chinese investment at a cost of £18 billion, refused to provide information on the cause of the explosion, which is a bit worrying, isn't it? You really want to know what's going on straight away, especially for the local people who live around in the area. They've said it's a significant technical event, which I don't know quite what a technical event means, but not a nuclear accident. EDF have said the fire was immediately brought under control, but if you actually have a look at the facts, it was burning for several hours and they had to bring in all the local fire services from the area to put it out. 20 of EDF's 58 nuclear plants in France were shut down following safety checks last year, and some of the reactors are still offline. Anyway, this is a little bit worrying, isn't it? Number one, when you get a nuclear accident of some sort, a disaster, a fire in a nuclear power station, and then secondly, when we're told by the people that run it that they're not going to be providing information on the cause of the explosion.
Certainly, yes, you're right. There are some concerns. I would certainly echo what you've just said to me, Tony. I think from where I know we are in terms of nuclear inspectorate and so on in this country, I think we've actually got a very, very strong nuclear inspectorate. I will confess to having a good friend who works in it, so I've got a little bit of an insight into that, and I'm very confident that our regulations will hopefully address all those concerns. I can't talk about what's been happening in France.
Well, people always say that, don't they? Oh, it's going to be okay until something happens. And you've got the design of this Hinkley station being based around the pressurised water PWR type of reactor, which is the same type of reactor as we had at Three Mile Island, Chernobyl and Fukushima. So it's a bit worrying. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of this accident over in France? Flamanville is seen really as a kind of test case for Hinkley.
Well, obviously it's a technical matter. I mean, I'm not a nuclear safety expert.
Well, okay, the fire's in the turbine hall, which is next to the reactor, so it's not actually in the reactor itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not really an international story, because if there was a nuclear explosion of a Chernobyl kind in Flamanville, we would no doubt be affected where we are here, as we were during Chernobyl, for example, which was, you know, hundreds of miles away. Of course, Fukushima, which was dropped out of the news, is still in a very, very unstable state and causing all kinds of problems to the Pacific Ocean.
I was reading just the other day, apparently one of the reactor cores appears at Fukushima to have just disappeared.
Well, from an economic point of view, I'd point out that nuclear power in France, and they're probably one of the countries that generate most of the biggest nuclear industry in terms of, you know, generating their electricity. It's very much a result of socialist, dirigiste government planning. It's certainly not a private sector operation in its fundamentals. And I'm afraid that is how nuclear, if you look at the economics of nuclear power, it has to be subsidised, because in actual fact, it's not competitive, and it never has been.
Anyway, Tim,
which is why the privatisation of the nuclear industry in the 1980s didn't work, because when the private sector looked at the books, they suddenly thought, goodness me, we don't want to do that.
Anyway, Tim, your responsibility of Metro Mayor, should you win, would not be Hinckley or Flamanville. So let's get back to something which you would be responsible for, which is housing. And we've had a housing white paper this week, which was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Yes, we have.
Mr. Speaker, the people of Rossendale and Darwin warmly welcome the government's housing white paper. Will my right honourable friend confirm that when it comes to providing more security for renters, building more affordable homes and helping people buy their own home, it is this party, the Conservative Party, that is fixing our broken housing market?
I'm very happy to agree with my honourable friend. Our broken housing market, I think, is one of the greatest barriers to progress in Britain today. And the housing white paper, the excellent housing white paper brought out by my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government, sets out the steps we'll take to fix it. And my honourable friend is right. It's the Conservatives in government who are going to support local authorities to deliver more of the right homes in the right places, to encourage faster build-out of developments. I'm sure everybody recognises the problem of planning permissions that are given and then not built out, and create the conditions for a more competitive and diverse housing market. We're calling for action. We're setting out the responsibilities of all parties in building the homes that Britain needs.
Well, we've had a Conservative Prime Minister for quite a while now, 6 years or so. Why are we still in this broken housing market, Tim?
Well, we've got a long legacy here, I'm afraid. It goes back a lot more than just the last few years. For the last few decades, we haven't been building enough homes.
What would you think is the main cause for the housing crisis now?
It comes down, in a sense, to the supply of new homes. We've had growing populations, increased demand for more homes, and the market simply hasn't been delivering enough. And that's why both the white paper and what the Prime Minister is talking about is going to be really important. It's about trying to get the housing market moving, developing the homes that people need. So it has to be that wide range of different types of homes.
I mean, isn't there a problem here in that you've got to try and make sure that the house prices keep going up as a government? I mean, there's a lot of pressure on governments to make sure house prices don't start falling, because then that reduces confidence in the entire economy. I mean, the housing market is seen as one of the bedrocks of the economy. So if you start building enough houses, then house prices might level out or even start falling.
In terms of negative equity, which is what you're touching on, I think a lot of us can remember times like that and the real damage that does to all of those people in that situation. So it is important, again, that we've got that right mix of housing. So it has to be a broad approach to these things. We have to get the right sort of houses in the right sort of places where the jobs are to provide that. And if we start doing that, it'll help the economy, because it will start bringing in new jobs. It'll help boost the economy in the area, so it will actually have a positive
effect.
I mean,
you've had this big housing estate, loads of houses being built up at Filton, which is in South Gloucestershire. You're part of the world, really. But a lot of those places are very small. They don't have any kind of front gardens. I mean, they're talked of it by housing developers around the region as some of the worst houses that have been built in the region for many years. And so it looks like we're getting, and also, of course, very, very expensive. So it doesn't look like we're getting a good deal over the last, the years of the coalition government and the recent Conservative government in housing.
Okay. As I say, Tony, I really do think this issue goes back an awful lot further than the last few years. And if we want to look at it on a party political basis, I'm afraid that the Labour government in power for 13 years certainly weren't
okay.
Delivering.
So what would you do to make sure we get houses with decent-sized rooms that don't have mirrors and things to try and make it look bigger?
As I said, I'm pleased you've asked that, because, yes, we need to move this forward and not look backwards. We need to start freeing up the land that where people want to live, where near to where the jobs are, near where the infrastructure is, to start providing that net level of homes. In terms of room sizes, that is something that comes down very much as part of the planning process, but it would be based around developers finding where the needs are and meeting those needs of people. In terms of mirrors in bedrooms, I'm afraid I'm not an authority on that.
Well, Sajid Javid, who's the community secretary, came up with a very interesting, almost like a complete policy shift historically, and he's saying that between home ownership and renting, he said it's a false choice. The reality is we need more homes, whether to rent or buy. So is the whole idea of Conservative governments trying to make sure people can own their own home, is that out of the window now?
I think what the Minister's saying there is we all accept there is a mix. We do have to have that mix. I know it's vital that we have that. It's vital in terms of having rental estates, in terms of people's movement with work. So there does need to be a mix, both of rental and purchase, without a doubt, Tony, and it's something we've got to do to start solving these problems we all face.
Well, I think Tim's right that the problems in the housing market go back a long way. I mean, you could take it back to the 1920s when Conservative governments decided that they wanted to create a home-owning democracy and therefore gave all sorts of tax and financial advantages to those who bought their own homes, which then, of course, created a political base that they wanted to create. But also in the 1950s, Conservative government, the Macmillan government, was actually the government that built the most council housing in Britain, because there was a consensus across the board.
Martin, do you see this as a policy shift? Sajid Javid is saying whether you're renting or owning your own home is a false choice now.
Well, this is a belated recognition by the government that there is a housing crisis. And I take Tim's point. There was 13 years of Labour government where they didn't overturn the previous regulations about councils spending money on building houses. We know that Bristol City Council would love to go out there and build more houses, but they're trapped by the government's own regulations which prevent it. And, of course, those who are in the social housing sector will know that the right to buy by social housing tenants, and that does strike me as very odd, because these are supposedly independent organisations, but they've been told what to do with their assets by the government. And of course that is actually if the real crisis in housing is for people on low incomes, which the Macmillan government well understood. You create council housing for people. Not everybody's going to own their own home. It's an irrational desire. I mean, in some European countries like Switzerland, for example, hardly anybody owns their own home. We get used to it being normal here, and it's got very big macroeconomic implications for the way the economy runs. So classically, you get what's called stop-go. So the economy starts to pick up. The housing market in the southeast takes off, and then the Chancellor of the Exchequer of the day, whoever it is, has to put the brakes on, and then you get the stop. But of course, what that does is it drags resources out of the industrial regions north of the Wash and concentrates it all in what I call the inflationist block.
Is there any industry really left up there?
Well, no, because we've had successive waves of these property bubbles in the southeast, which have deindustrialised the north. Now, in the 1950s. Conservative governments understood that you had to have a regional policy to balance that out, including using council houses as a means to stabilise the private housing market. If people have a real choice, then and everybody shouldn't necessarily aspire to own their own home. For those who want to, and it's fine, but you can't run the whole thing as a lottery for those who own their own homes and everybody else.
On ITV News a couple of weeks ago, I remember seeing Allegra Stratton talking about this housing crisis and saying, well, actually, we're going to have to build on the green belt. But in the background, one of the things she didn't mention is there's hundreds of thousands of homes which we've got planning permission for, but the developers aren't building them because they don't think they can sell them at the price they want to.
I think you've just answered the point there, at the price they want to. I think the important thing there, and we see it for all of those that are involved in local government, about five-year land supplies and challenges that we're constantly getting in terms of that, to try and allow developers to develop even further in terms of permissions. So I think it is important that we start talking to developers, getting them starting building. We need to see more people getting the keys to the front door.
But if they can't make enough profit, they're not going to build, are they?
Well, that comes down to the prices that they're paying for land and so on. So it is that whole vicious circle there. We need to be looking at that and getting that whole process moving, speeding up, freeing up the ability for people to start building homes, getting a more competitive market, encouraging smaller developers coming into the market, things of that nature, and then that process will speed things up.
You can't force people to build on land they own if they think they can make more money by sitting on it as a speculator.
That's right. And that's where you then start talking about planning permission and how long those permissions last. And at what point they may actually...
Yeah, I mean, you could have a sort of use it or lose it policy, couldn't you?
My point entirely, yes.
Well, that sounds interesting. I mean, because the thing is, for example, nowadays, if a business is putting its money in the bank, it's getting pretty much zero interest rates. Talking about actually charging people to put their money in the bank, so they're starting to use land as actually a better way of making money than leaving the money. There's just land banking. So how are you going to stop that?
Well, you're right. The phrase is land banking, and it's something we see a lot of. And that's why, if we go back to the points that Martin was making as well, if the process encourages people to build and build promptly and quickly, that will certainly start addressing this issue. But at the end of the day, it really is about trying to get that land freed up, looking at other areas, other brownfield sites, bringing more supply of land into the market, and that will then start...
Would you be prepared to sanction compulsory purchase, requisitioning land effectively that wasn't being built on, owned by developers who are speculating with it?
I'd certainly look at land that's owned by government, local authorities, and look at ways we can try and speed that
up. What about private developers? These are the big guys that are not... I mean, the local authorities seem to be moving on making land available for housing in various different ways. We've heard over the last few weeks about that here in Bristol. What about the private owners? They say, this is our land, and actually we want to keep it because we think it's going to go up in value over the next few years. We're not building on it. I mean, we've got this enormous piece of land right in the centre of Bristol here in St Paul's, Dove Street, which places for people bought about 10 years ago, demolished everything on it, and it's just been sitting there ever since. It's for them. They're not interested in building houses. They're just interested in selling the land on to somebody else in the future for vast amounts of money.
I think we're getting...
I would suggest.
I was just going to say, thank you, that's what I was about to say. I think we are getting into, and you then I think you picked up
well,
what I was going to say.
Well, I think people in St Paul's are angry that piece of land, right in the middle of where they live, is just being used as a speculation. We can see all around that area is starting to be gentrified, so the value of that land is going up. Places for people are sitting on it, waiting for the value of the land to go up enough to build. Well, they should be building now. Yeah.
And I think, if I may, that goes back to the point we were, both Martin and I were saying, this has been an issue that's been around for quite some time. It's not a very new one. And that's why we need to start looking at the ways we can actually get this, the whole housing market moving.
On that point, I mean, would you be against building council houses as a Conservative? Would you be prepared to see them as the mix, in the mix that you're talking about?
From a personal perspective, I'd encourage any form of house building. So there's lots of different routes to that now. Housing associations, as you know, in terms of housing stocks, are involved. So I'd be happy to encourage as much housing building as we can.
We've got a multi-party administration here in Bristol, with the Conservatives in coalition with all the other parties. And the Conservatives that we've had on the programme here are happy to say that they would like to build council houses where it's appropriate. And that's why I'm pushing you on it, because that's what
I'll push you a little bit too, Tim, in a line. How are you going to make sure those houses are built? Because we hear this year after year after year, oh, we want to build my house. It just never happens.
Okay. Making sure that the process is efficient in terms of getting planning permissions, making sure that there are the incentives there for the builders to start building houses, and making sure that we're planning the right mix of houses in them. I mean, that's the process, and we've got to get all of those things in place.
Okay, another story this week, a shock report, bungling council mismanagement. That's not me, that's Ian Onions in the Bristol Post. Leads to £29 million cock-up. A damning picture of mismanagement by Bristol's council chiefs has been exposed in a shock independent, in inverted commas, report published, which found a collective failure of leadership within the council for which several people, including politicians, bear responsibility. An entire annual budget for 2016-17 approved on the basis of false assumptions that previously agreed cuts had been fully carried out and savings delivered when they hadn't. An unwillingness to accept bad news amongst the council's senior leadership team. Reports which misled councillors because they were so consistently over-optimistic, and routine practice of which saw officers bury information in big reports reports. The bungling, and there is even a reference to bullying, led to £29 million shortfall emerging soon after Marvin Rees was elected as Bristol Mayor last May. The deficit sent shockwaves through the City Hall, and Mr Rees ordered an inquiry to find out where the money had gone. I tweeted this week, maybe the police can help us find that money, because we need people who are honest accountants, and we need proper auditing at the City Council, and that doesn't look as if it's been happening. Anyway, I would love to have asked Marvin Rees all about this, but I'll tell you what, they've got this wonderful YouTube channel where he speaks, so let's hear what he had to say about that. The Mayor, Labour Mayor for Bristol City Council, before we hear from Tim Bowles, who's the candidate for Metro Mayor for the Conservatives.
When I was elected, I promised to bring transparency to the council, and I also promised to get a handle on the council's finances. The publication of this report is a delivery against that promise. We have some work to do, but it is delivery in bringing transparency and assurance. I believe one of the most important things we can deliver to Bristol is by 2020 is a financially sure and a financially competent local authority. And that is what we are going to deliver. We're committed to our manifesto commitments, but to make sure that Bristol City Council is fit as an anchor institution in Bristol is essential. So I value the support you've offered across as individuals, as community groups, as city partners, and I thank you for staying with us. But rest assured, as the report points out, we are heading in the right direction, and we will deliver the local authority Bristol needs and deserves.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I would like to have heard him really naming names, etc. there, Marvin. But we do seem to be getting this kind of Marvin speak, where he's talking about things like competency, transparency. We've still got work to do. We need to have a conversation around. We are an anchor institution, these kinds of things. And I don't really feel that Marvin got to grips with pointing the finger and explaining exactly what he's going to do about it. Anyway, Tim, this is pretty shocking, isn't it? £29 million has gone astray.
It's a very surprising report, and I think everybody I've spoken to thinks the same. You were talking about honesty and transparency. I think it would be nice to see a little bit more transparency behind something that's happened in the past, but as I'm not involved with Bristol City Council, personally I can't throw any light on that. I can talk about my personal experiences with our council, and I know that those of us that are involved in the finance side there work very, very hard across all parties and together in terms of scrutinising what information we are given. Budgets of this nature, as you said earlier, are very large and significant, and we do rely a great deal on the reports that we're given by our officers. Personally, my faith in the offices in South Gloucestershire is very high. I can't really comment on the detail behind this one, but yes, I agree, it's rather surprising.
Martin Summers, Jeff Gollop, former cabinet member for finance and deputy mayor, is in the firing line in this report. It says, although there was monthly reporting to the assistant mayor for business change and deputy mayor, half-yearly reporting to cabinet provided very little opportunity for emerging problems to be identified as early enough stage for them to be addressed. Mr. Gollop, who was paid around £20,000 for his role as deputy mayor, said the report was a very depressing document. As a ward councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henlees, he said it raised serious questions about officers at the time. He repeatedly reassured him that the budget was balanced under George Ferguson. Now I'm getting sort of echoes of 2008 here. This is people being presented with accounts. You could even say false accounting. You know, here's some accounts, but actually what's written on the paper doesn't add up to, or doesn't correlate with the real world.
Well, I think there's pressure on the politicians, whether it's George Ferguson or Marvin Rees, to try and find, you know, to try not to make cuts before elections. And I think that may, I'm not saying it did, I'm saying that may have something to do with this, is that George Ferguson, you know, he'd quite liked being Santa Claus, but you can't be Santa Claus without, you know, you then have to pay for it. And I don't know whether that's what happened or whether we're just dealing with incompetence. Which
well,
is,
fraud,
which is
fraud and false accounting are criminal offences.
Well, that may be so, but I don't know enough of the detail of this to say what exactly has occurred.
Now, well, if you remember,
Martin,
if you remember back in 2013, we covered on this programme the fact that Matt Payne, who worked for KPMG, right in the early days of the Ferguson administration, was brought in as a volunteer to work. KPMG are one of the big six accounting firms, auditing firms. Actually, maybe it's big four. Like Deloitte's, etc., and they have an appalling record. I mean, they were involved in many of the audits of the banks in the run-up to 2008, which proved to be worthless, in fact, fraudulent. And there was an investigation in February 2013 by the Competition Commission into these big four audit firms. In 2005, KPMG agreed to pay $500,000 to the US authorities to avoid prosecution for aggressively marketing tax avoidance schemes, for example. So these people who are in charge are supposed to be looking at the books, just don't seem to be trustworthy.
Well, I think one of the problems with local authorities is because the sort of financial intermediation that's gone on, they find that they're actually involved with all sorts of things that they didn't even realise that were risky. I remember Hammersmith and Fulham Council years ago was persuaded by its advisers to take out swaps, interest rate swaps, in order to hedge against changes in interest rates, and suddenly found themselves on the hook for an enormous amount of money when these trades went sour. And I think that's true a lot in the United States of America as well. Lots of local authorities and local governments are actually intimately involved in Wall Street and everything and all of its works. And the days when local authorities just sort of, you know, collected the rubbish and stuff have long gone. I mean, they're
not even doing that anymore, Martin. Let me point out Marvin's wonderful new scheme is that we don't collect the rubbish, you do. Tim Bowles, you're standing as a Conservative Metro Mayor. We're also in the situation with KPMG. This is a story from April 2013, going back a bit here. But KPMG volunteers were spying on HMRC, and they were taking information about the government tax collection people back and using it inappropriately. Well, I mean, it seems bizarre that the government people should accept volunteers in when it's quite clearly they have an intelligence gathering role. They're taking information back to KPMG. Can we rely on these big auditors like Deloitte's KPMG? It just sounds to me like they are not doing their job properly.
I think if you're talking about an individual who, from what we were talking about earlier, I believe has come in on a voluntary basis into Bristol City Council with the previous mayor, yes, I think that you could reasonably ask questions around that. In terms of the auditing role within councils, that is very rigorous in terms of how that works, and I think there's two very slight, very different aspects there. But certainly, if somebody is coming in on a personal basis to try and exploit that position, I'm sorry, that's wrong.
Right. Finally, Labour sets up a working group to investigate universal basic income, Martin. John McDonnell's revealed last weekend.
Well, I mean, this is an idea that's being kicked around a lot around the world. I mean, in Finland and Canada and other places, it's being looked at. I think in the long run, we're going to have to look at rebuilding a welfare system, not based on universal credit, which is basically still a means-tested benefit, effectively. I think we're going to have to try reform the welfare system so that it really is a solid safety net.
Tim, what do you make of this? Reducing bureaucracy, certainly at the Department for Work and Pensions, but the idea that everybody is entitled to a basic amount which enables them to live.
I think, if I may, I'll go back to what Martin was saying as well in terms of reform of the welfare system, and I totally agree. I and everybody I know supports, as we said earlier, with the NHS, the welfare system. It should be there for people in need. It should be there to help people who are in hardship, and really that's the important thing, and I think we've got to address that.
OK, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, Conservative Metro Mayor candidate Tim Bowles. After the Murdoch News, 500,000 children are under threat of starvation in Yemen as we speak. So we're bringing in someone who's a real expert on Yemen and talk it right through.
Station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.